Now I go to my profile and I see I have to scroll down and we did it. We did it. We are live, Simon.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah. I'm very excited about this and it's so wonderful to have you as a guest here. And I see Guy Mission is here and thank you very much. And I see the Living logo. So again, thank you so much for being here. And I've been watching you as well. And what a wonderful host you are. I see Mark is here. So Mark, thank you very much for being here. And especially thank you to the person I have the pleasure of looking at. So thank you very much, Simon Mihaljevic. Is that right?
That's pretty close. That's as close as it gets.
That's as close as I can get. That's it. I have a little bit of a list, but I'm not good at even pronunciation within my own words. So I keep it simple. So I want to thank you so much for being here. And this is investor series number, this is number five. So at first we had Valina, then we had Tracy, then we had Mark Schneider, then we had Anthony Pompliano. So they're in very distinguished company because now they've got you. So I want to thank you very much, Simon, for being here. Would you be kind enough to introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. You said my name is Simon Mihaljevic. I'm the founder and the managing member, whatever you want to call it, of the Bullion Reserve. I've been in the investment business. I grew up in the Soviet Union. I came here when I was 19 with a suitcase and $100, not the proverbial $100, actual $100.
Wow.
That was capital controls in the Soviet Union. You were allowed, every person was allowed to exchange $100 worth of dollars. That's simple. Yeah. And you could take a 20 kilo suitcase and no passport. You had to give that up.
Wow.
So we came with the family into the United States. So it's 1978, 79. And I've been in the investment business for, I guess, now 35, 36 years. Of which the last previously mostly workouts, credit, distressed investing, and 20 years, the last 20 whatever years, structured credit. The big short, little short, whatever. Videos, all that.
Yeah.
And so in 2012, 13, 14, I fully focused on gold. Switched, closed my other business. And that was born out of basically three factors. One was the conclusion that I drew after the 2008 crisis that the financial system and the monetary system that we have and the debt levels that we have put us on the path of some sort of massive restructuring, called balance sheet restructuring, redenomination, whatever you want to call it, the great devaluation. Because if the assets and claims on those assets are not backed by real cash flows, then at some point you have to restructure the assets. And because every dollar of debt is somebody's asset, then if the debts cannot be paid, that means the assets need to be adjusted to the level of whatever can be paid or recovered from restructuring. The second insight that I reached was that, because that raises the question, because if one puts it that way, then you'd have to say, so what do I do? You know, if I'm a trader, I mean, I can trade until when, you know, who knows how long it takes till this unwinding happens, but I can trade through it or until it. But if you're not a trader, if you're a long-term fundamental investor, then you kind of have to step back and say, like, if I don't know what's going on, if I don't understand these values, then how do I sequester? Basically, how do I get out of the market and preserve my savings or my wealth or whatever until such time as I'm ready to go back and buy again. I mentioned to you before we started, Jesse Livermore was the trader, the famous 1930s trader who said that it's the sitting that made me all the money, not the trading. It's finding the big idea and just being patient until it fully realizes itself. And so I look for ideas and for something. What I realize is that the only financial asset that was independent from the financial system was physical gold.
Yeah,
we can talk about what about it is interesting. It has a lot of properties that are not particularly interesting in normal times, when financial assets are performing fine, and when the property rights are secure, when social structure is secure. it's an asset that doesn't have a tremendous appeal during as a financial asset during those periods. But it's a financial asset par excellence when in period when confidence in normal arrangements either drops or disappears or collapses. And that's where gold gains purchasing power while remaining completely independent from the financial system. So if the problem is the financial system, then the backup to that has to be something that's not connected to it. And so that was the second insight. And the third insight was realization that if you want to execute a strategy, if I wanted to execute a strategy like that, I had to figure out how to actually do it in a way that would channel the this insight of being independent from the financial system. Like, for example, exchange-traded funds provide exposure to the price of gold, but themselves are normal financial instruments like all the others. And so to the extent that there's a problem in the financial system, they would have the same problem, and the claim that you have against them could be taken away from you or changed or whatever, taxed or whatever, without your ability to control anything. So there's no, you don't have any optionality. And so the business that I migrated into or switched my credit business into, it was specifically built on the idea as to how to execute this strategy correctly, with all the benefit of hindsight and experience that I have, both coming from the Soviet Union with $100 and getting that in one piece, and then with generally, you know, operating internationally and accessing various sources of liquidity in different places in a legitimate way, without carrying cash in suitcases, kind of thing. That's really my background and what I do and why I do it. And it seems to me like as time goes on, it's becoming more compelling rather than less compelling.
Yeah, that was remarkable. So thank you very much for that. I didn't realize, we had spoken for, we had a very pleasant conversation yesterday, and you didn't include within that the your migration from Russia with $100. That's really remarkable. Congratulations, you did it. So conceptual framework. So last week we were discussing Bitcoin, right? One of the, you know, Anthony Pompliano, who was kind enough to join us, is an evangelist for it, and he's also a participant, right? So we have to kind of qualify and quantify it like that. And part of his argument, and I think part of the ideological almost argument that surrounds Bitcoin is as a substitute. And part of that is even as a substitute for gold itself, perhaps because of the distribution mechanisms or perhaps even a novelty in the science, which, you know, of course has some value. And I, so many people perceive it as a substitute. How do you look at Bitcoin? Do you see that as a substituent or something that can kind of, if one goes up, the other will go up? Because there has been overall within the market, S&P has gone up, gold has gone up, Bitcoin has gone up. So there's been some harmony.
Well, look, I mean, it all depends on what the idea is. I mean, if somebody is saying that the price of Bitcoin is going to go up and therefore you should buy it and it's going to go up because of these reasons, well, it possible, but I don't know. It makes sense. I mean, intellectually, it makes sense. If the question is whether Bitcoin is like gold, then I would say unambiguously that we do not have an answer to that question. We have ideas. Yeah. People have ideas about it, but ideas are not facts. And so we don't have facts. Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies in general have never been through a systemic crisis. They have never been subject of government sanctions, specifically point of government sanctions. They have never, that technology is 10 years old. If we know anything about Moore's law and technology, is that technology evolves. There's really almost no technology that has not evolved. So whether Bitcoin today is the same impregnable Bitcoin 5, 10, 20 years from now, at the level of technology, we don't know. So what we do know, however, is that Bitcoin and all cryptocurrencies and any digital assets in general, they rely on a couple of things. They rely on the networks and they rely on the state of cryptography. So the state of cryptography meaning is that as long as the algorithms that they use have not been quote unquote broken, they, I don't know if you want to call it impregnable, but electronically, at least they are unhackable.
Yeah.
That the infrastructure around it, they live in the infrastructure, and the infrastructure is hackable. And we've seen tons of thefts from exchanges, wallets, and all kinds of stuff. You know, gold is proven over millennia. It is required. It doesn't have any network. It can be sitting in your pocket, and you can hand it over to the next guy under the table in a room where nobody else is watching. The transactions are not traceable. See, the other thing is, I mean, this is my sort of Soviet background, but I don't know why it's a good idea. I mean, people think it's a good idea, and for some things it is a good idea, but I don't know for safe haven, why is it a good idea that every transaction is immutably and permanently recorded in a database that cannot be erased. So why is that great? So that if at some future point this algorithm is broken because of quantum computing or something else, then every transaction you've ever done can be unwound. It's like a credit card. It's like basically like a encrypted credit card, where where every transaction ever you've ever performed with anybody for any reason is in a database, and all it takes is for somebody to get access to the database, and you're counting on the fact that nobody will ever get access to that database. Well, you know, ever is a long time.
Yeah, I think ever really is a long time. It could be. We'll find out.
We'll find out. So is ever 5 years, or is ever 30 years, or 50 years, or 100 years? So that's, I think that that's relevant. And so to the extent that people are looking for a trade, I don't have any comment about that.
Yeah.
To the extent that people are looking for a safe haven that they can have some level of confidence that it works as advertised, I think the conclusions are premature. The thesis is I hear the thesis, but the conclusions are, you know, scientific method requires proof. I don't think it's been proof tested. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and I'm kind of a Hayekian, maybe a Karl Popperian. So whenever I see science, I'm always looking for that test that's going to disprove it. It's just the anarchist in me.
I'm not against it. I'm looking for something sure that's not sure.
Yeah, and I don't want to put you in as an adversary in the Thunderdome against Bitcoin, right? So
I own some. I just don't see it the same way.
Yeah. So the way I see Bitcoin, and you know, I can be persuaded one way or the other because clearly things are changing. I mean, the underlying thesis that you guys are expressing. When I say you guys, I don't mean to put you in a position of a gold advocate, or we're discussing your strategy. So I'm just discussing both conceptual frameworks kind of complementing each other. And both of them see kind of a deterioration in the dollar, and see competition and see the consequences of a lot of money being printed. And I think both of them would have to forecast a lot of taxes, a lot of more intricacies in wealth preservation, right? Because for the last 50 years, wealth preservation has been you buy your house, you give it to your kids sell it, they turn it into 10 condos and everything is good, right?
Right.
So, but that's certainly changing because the more taxes are introduced into the system, the more wealth extraction. And that also means there's a commensurate amount of hiring that the government does for compliance and enforcement of these things. And eventually they can just make things so complex that it creates a whole new market in itself, which is what we've seen in Europe and in other countries where there's actually a gray market in trading for receipts, for bills of ladings, and for goods that were never delivered. And there just gets to be a new complexity.
Well, you mentioned something there about the dollar. I think there's a tremendous attachment that most people who discuss gold and Bitcoin, and very strong views, by the way, have versus, you know, about the dollar and whether it continues to be the reserve currency and whether it's, you know, the value of the dollar is up and down. I think that's a very complicated discussion that I don't think is very relevant. And the reason it's not very relevant is because when you say that the dollar goes, it's like against what?
Like
and the other thing is which dollar? And let me give you an example. So the 1930s, the value of the dollar went through the roof in terms of purchasing power. The government devalued the dollar by 70%. Gold went up by whatever, 70, it revalued gold up by 75%.
Yeah.
The reason gold went up, and the reason gold would have been so valuable, and that's why the government confiscated it, or not confiscated it, nationalized it. I'm sorry, they nationalized it. So they paid you $20 an ounce or whatever, $20 something an ounce, and then they revalued it to $35 an ounce. It's because the dollar that's in the sky was very valuable. The dollar that you had in your bank account was gone. So when people say the dollar this or that, you need to distinguish between the hypothetical dollar that's somewhere on the screen and actual your money.
Well, I'm a pragmatist. I refer to the dollar that's in my theoretical wallet, because I don't carry a wallet too much anymore. But if I did, I would be referring to that sliver of paper that's in it.
Well, it's easy to redenominate. I mean, there could be look at India. I mean, they just went and canceled, 75% of cash in circulation and redenominated it, and that's
India.
And if you had too much cash, then maybe you couldn't. You lost it, or you had to hire peasants in the countryside to carry, like mules, to carry $1,000 worth to the bank to exchange it, and the cost of that exchange, I'm sure, was tremendous. So my point is in the financial markets, we fixate on these very specific things because everybody wants to get a very specific trade and they want to get it on and they want to win. And what I'm saying is that in the transition that we're facing, it's very, very difficult, probably almost impossible, to pin any kind of trade and then to execute that trade and then to get paid if you win. Because if you bought protection credit default swaps from Lehman Brothers, you didn't get paid.
Yeah.
So you don't buy protection against collapse of Lehman Brothers from Lehman Brothers. You won't get paid. I mean, you may win, but you won't get paid. And so I think that's how I got to gold and physical gold, because nobody needs to pay anything. It's a thing.
Yeah.
It's not anybody's promise to do something if something else happens.
So gold really complements my kind of theory, and I'm by no means one of those people that pound the desk on gold. And usually when people pound a desk on gold, I kind of get up and go. Anyway, right? So, but it does complement my kind of investment thesis, right? And I've shared it with a lot of people. And